We are starting the Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and stories, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change, and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests, or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. Music and Poetry Show. In today's show, I interview Kevin Kumar, one of the founders of a lovely local chamber music group called Celestina. We start the show with a piece by Brianna Tam, innovative loop cellist, performing Unholy by Sam Smith. Then a piece by William Walton, The Princess in the Tower. That's from his Shakespeare suite, Richard III. That's performed by Celestina. Then the interview. Then another piece performed by Celestina, Debussy's Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun. Then a poem read by Quanah J. Hicks, The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe. You can find him on Instagram at Poets of Yore. I'm going to feature a whole program with Quanah J. Hicks next week, and this is just a little tease. You'll love his work. And we wrap up the show with two pieces by John von Segern from his album just about to be released called Ambient Bass Guitar. We'll hear Adumbrations and Reflection. And John will be performing at the Philosophical Research Society in Pasadena, an ambient bass sound bath on June 15th. Tickets on Eventbrite. Mystic Pete Chronicles, stay tuned. Thank you. It's May 12, 2023. Mystic Pete here with Kevin Kumar.
Hi.
Your violin player. And you have helped to organize Celestina.
Well, yeah, so I was, I'm the co-artistic director right now, and I co-founded it. That was 13 years ago. I started it with my friend, Maya Jasper White. Now that I think about it, we've literally raised a teenager. I just hadn't thought about it until now. 13 years. We call ourselves classical music's wingman. And that's because when we started Celestina, it was really a reaction to all the things that we didn't like about the classical concert experience. Not only like for the audience, but also for the musicians too. So what we didn't like was this idea that the artist is some kind of a high priest, you know, who's deigning to come out and give the word of God to the unwashed masses.
Like an exclusivity.
Yeah, yeah. For us, I think the ethos behind what we do is that we are sharing something that we love. So our concerts just feel completely different. Like if you walk into the concert hall, it's more likely than not that one of the musicians will like chat you up and welcome you. You know, there's a lot of banter from the stage. We have a resident host. If you listen to, can I talk about other radio stations here?
Oh, okay, go ahead.
KUSC, there's a host named Brian Lauritsen, and he's actually our resident host, and he does a lot of storytelling from the stage. He will engage the audience with questions, and it's not a pre-concert talk. This is like literally part of the event, you know. And he provides context for what the audience is going to hear. So the feel is meant to be very friendly, you know. We have a lot of respect for the music that we're playing, but that doesn't mean to us that like the atmosphere can't be friendly. That's why we started Celestina, so that we could be a part of that too, and we find it much more fulfilling to do that rather than to have the separation between us and the audience. You know, I mean, we like people, which I know is unusual for a lot of musicians, but we really do, genuinely do.
There's a lot of different conversations within the arts, various facets. And this is one of them, mm-hmm. and that's the audience-artist relationship. Some artists want to be the star right. and revered and bowed down to
right.
and love celebrity.
Yeah.
Other people in the arts want to break the fourth wall
right.
and, like you're saying, have it be an experience of coming into your living room. Welcome, everybody's a part of this, yeah. and people relaxing. I mean, I'm more of this ilk.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's, I think actually it's just a matter of when you can look at somebody in the eye and just talk to them, right? I think that already changes the dynamic between you. You know, when you're on stage and like you have that just physical separation, the lights are on you, you can't really see into the audience, you know, there is that built-in sort of wall between, I don't know, a wall, but I would say, you know, there is a distance that's there, and I think it serves a lot of different purposes, including what you talked about, like maintaining this sort of reverence for the performer.
Well, on the one hand, you want people to relax and to be able to enjoy the art,
yeah.
but on the other hand, you need a certain decorum, so people can hear the music. I mean, if you set up in the middle of the 405 freeway,
yeah.
it'll be harder for people to enjoy.
Right.
Well, on your next concerts, it's Mahler's Song of the Earth.
That's right, yeah.
So, yes, you need a certain formality, but you're trying to yeah. have as little of that as possible so people can enjoy the music.
We talk to a lot of audience members who come to classical music for the first time. They come to our event, and afterwards, they tell us their fears about just even coming to the concert. Like, they're not sure that they'll be welcomed. They're not sure how to behave. They're not sure what, you know, the rules are, you know. Like, what the culture is, you know. Are they going to be welcome? You know, and that makes us sad to hear, you know, that you need to have that kind of trepidation before, you know, just enjoying what we think is, you know, just some of the great human creations. You know what I mean? Like, why do you need that kind of fear there? And I think I personally cannot enjoy something as much when I'm afraid, you know, in the situation. So, so we try to eliminate those sources of fears as best we can. And I mean, people are smart. Like, they walk into the situation of a concert hall and, like, they look around and they see how other people are behaving. They know what to do, you know? And I think the people who come to our concerts, I mean, they get it. Like, they're not there to ruin anybody else's enjoyment, you know? So I think it's a win-win for everybody.
Well, classical music, because of its nature, does demand a certain kind of formality. I mean, it's just not going to work if there's a mosh pit going down in front of the stage.
Yeah.
Although I've tried that at L.A. Phil performance.
I want to see that.
Was dragged out by security. No. But, oh, you've played with L.A. Phil as a soloist, I see, in your bio.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, there is... I mean, you're right. Like, to enjoy this kind of music, people can't be, like, talking and, like... I don't even know if it's that so much as, like, when people go into the hall and they sit down and it's clear what's happening, that, like, the show is not about them, but it's about this communal experience, then people just sort of, they just get it, you know? And I don't know if it's a formality, it's just, like, a sensitivity to what's happening around them, you know? But I have to say, like, one of my favorite experiences, we commissioned a piece at our first concert, our very, very first concert, it was our debut. And, it was this sort of crazy combination of things. I mean, we were playing all this really sort of like these pillars of like the classical music canon. We also had Seth Rogen there. Seth Rogen was narrating Ferdinand the Bull.
Okay.
Okay.
You know what?
And
let's
we,
do it.
And we also had, like I said, this commission that we had done. It was three Neruda arias. So a friend of ours, he composed this piece that was, you know, on the poetry of Pablo Neruda. And there was a moment in one of the Neruda arias where there was this modulation, you know, and it was unexpected, but people in the audience broke out into applause and they were cheering for it, you know, which never happens at a classical music concert, like, right?
Yes.
I mean, I don't know if anybody cheers for modulations, you know?
That's not typical.
It's not typical, but they just were, I don't know, they felt comfortable enough to do that, but I mean, but it also just carried them and they did that. And I don't think of that as, you know, breaking this sort of sacred trust between the audience and the performer. You know, it was just a spontaneous thing. And I mean, we were all surprised by it, but we were also just really happy that had happened as well.
As a classically trained cellist who no longer really plays classical music, but I do music meditation, where everybody closes their eyes, don't look at me, and just drift out and have a vision and talk to your ancestors or whatever people do in these things, right?
Yeah.
I intentionally craft a situation so people can enter this kind of trance-like, dream-like state.
Mm. That's with, like, the surroundings and
well, meditation. It has to be absolutely quiet. Right. If there's just one person talking or any kind of disturbance, it'll take everybody out of their meditation. So it has to be, like, really like a church for me to do what I'm trying to do. But I think artists in general understand this experience, both as a performer. I'm sure you've been on stage either as a soloist or even part of a group where something happens, something transcendent happens, and it's almost like you're gone now and the music is playing through you. I mean, this is described, you know, throughout history as like the artist being almost a channel for the muse.
Yeah.
So it happens to the artist, but also for the audience, and you can feel it when everybody kind of sinks into this place, and they're just with you, and there's like a dissolving of the us and them.
I think that
experience.
That's beautifully put. I mean, I think that is the goal, and I think that's the magic of what we do, is when we can share that transcendent experience. Because I mean, when you have that experience with other people, you know, it's a different experience too than, you know, having it by yourself, you know. So I think, I mean, that is definitely the goal, and it is to be a channel and for something special to happen.
Yeah. Well, now you have this show at the Huntington's Rothberg Hall in San Marino. It's out kind of near Pasadena. Sunday, June 11th, starts at 7:30 p.m. As I said, you're going to be playing Mahler's Das Lied von der Erde, Song of the Earth. And this is, I guess, arranged by Schoenberg. Tell us about this. This is the final concert in this series.
The reason why we started Celestina was for this focus on live performance. These days, it is still our main focus, but we do other things as well. We do have something called Vital Sounds, and this started during COVID when loved ones couldn't be with, you know, their people in the hospital, you know, especially in the ICU because of these, you know, because of the rules. So we started doing private virtual concerts for the patients that were in the ICU.
Wow.
I think we've done something like, I might totally get this wrong, but I want to say 40,000 minutes, I think. 4,000 or 40,000 minutes. I have to check.
A lot.
A lot, yes. And that's the ICU at UCLA. So that's something that that we do regularly still. We also have an
education. Music is a healing modality. That's kind of cousin to what we were just talking about.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, the musicians who do it, I mean, they say it's, you know, it's a powerful experience for them as well, you know, as a patient. We also have an educational program. It's called Sounds Promising. And this past year, I think we had 160 applicants who were composers, fully funded scholarship, and they get to work with a composer mentor, an amazing composer whose name is Derek Skye, and then we premiere their pieces for them. We work with them. We give them a practical education on what it's like to be in a professional situation like this. How do you communicate with professional musicians? You know, how do you honor your deadlines, and how do you, you know, communicate if you can't? How do you get the best performance out of, you know, out of the musicians that you can? And how do you communicate your ideas fluently? And we have this just this incredible cohort of 10 composers all over the world, you know, who are just writing just, I mean, sort of mind-blowing music, you know. And then there's our live performances, and we have different kinds of live performances. You know, we have the ones that are like this concert that's coming up, which are, you know, you come to the concert and we, you know, we play music for you. When we talk to you, we play music for you. We have other concerts where we collaborate with a chef, and we pair, you know, we pair music with, you know, courses of food. You know, we have something also that's called a happy hour, where there's, it's kind of like this, you know, a musician will perform, except the musician will perform, and we just have a conversation. And the guests can be anybody from, I don't know if your listeners know Hilary Hahn, but she's a fantastic violinist. I think we had 1,000 people.
So some real namers come.
Alan Menken, okay. You know, who wrote all those Disney, you know, Disney movies like Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin.
So some real notable people come.
Yeah.
As well as just...
As well as, like, our friends, you know, and that is... It's kind of like a separate series that we do, the happy hour. But, yeah, okay. So this concert on June 11th at the Huntington Library and Gardens in Pasadena. First of all, I just want to say, like, if you get tickets to the concert, you have free admission to the Huntington grounds.
Okay, well, how can we resist?
Right?
It's gorgeous being there.
It's beautiful. Yes. It is beautiful. The concert is at Rothenburg Hall, and it is it's a beautiful venue. And we are performing, yes, Mahler's Das Lied von der Erde, which translates to the Song of the Earth. And this is a piece that I have been wanting to program for years. And, I mean, usually this is performed by a full symphony orchestra.
It's a Mahler piece,
yeah,
and it's big.
It is big. Two singer soloists, but, I mean, the orchestra is meant to be big. And actually, the concept of this was that this would be his ninth symphony. But for sort of like superstitious reasons, he didn't want to call it his ninth symphony. And so he called it, a symphony of song or something. I don't know. It's just something. He didn't formally title it his ninth symphony. Leonard Bernstein says this is the greatest Mahler symphony. The Song of the Earth is based on classical Chinese poetry, which has been translated to German. And, you know, Mahler was an Austrian Jew. You're performing it here in California. So it's just like this wonderful, I don't know, I'm going to say just cross-cultural phenomenon, you know. The poetry is about, so this is a song cycle. There's six songs in this, and there's an alto soloist and a tenor soloist. And the poetry is really about the fugitive quality of life, you know. And the poetry just captures this kind of special atmosphere, you know. Not only about, you know, like the vicissitudes of life, but also the pleasures as well, you know. And, you know, Mahler composed this at a time when he really just, like, a lot of terrible things happened to him. So I think he had just lost his eldest daughter to disease. He was diagnosed with some, I think, maybe heart failure or something like that. Because of anti-Semitism, I think he lost one of his, you know, director posts or something like that. And so he was at a place where he just felt like everything that he had up to that point was gone. You know, I think life as he understood it was just sort of turned around. And the poetry, with the subjects that I mentioned, you know, it appealed to him. And it's just a really heartfelt, special piece of music. I mean, it's hard to describe, you know. I mean, if you know Mahler, then, you know, it has the things that Mahler is really known for. But he does capture, like, I think, in the poetry, his poetic sensibility is on point here. Yeah.
Well, Mahler is kind of known as one of the most substantial of classical composers. So if you've never heard classical music, this is a way to really get into the meat and potatoes.
That's right, yeah.
But it's a beautiful, compelling piece.
It is, yeah.
And being performed in this lovely setting by a masterful orchestra. Say a word for the listeners who aren't familiar with it. Explain the difference between larger orchestras and chamber music, chamber orchestras. Well, people know about L.A. Phil,
right.
Los Angeles Philharmonic, Dudamel, they play at the Hollywood Bowl and Disney Hall. They may have heard of LACO, Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra.
That's right, yeah.
So, but explain a little, and the Los Angeles chamber music scene.
Sure, yeah. So the difference, I mean, I would say two sort of big differences between chamber music and chamber orchestra or orchestra. In chamber music, there's not a conductor, typically. That means that the musicians really have to communicate with each other, you know, and collectively come up with an interpretation of the music that they're playing. And usually there's only one person on a part, So you kind of have the best of both worlds. I mean, you're playing music with other people, but your own voice is being heard too.
Instead of 8 celli or 20 violinists.
Yeah, yeah. Usually, I mean,
one or two.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it's like the like Sibelius, like his dream was to have like a sea, you know, a sea of string instruments that just fade out into the distance. You know,
wall of sound. Yeah, like classical style.
Yeah, but in our case, we only perform chamber music, and so yes, Arnold Schoenberg. He had this sort of music society where they would take these gigantic these pieces for big forces, you know, for symphony forces, and they would reduce them. They would reduce them to having one person on a part. So I think we have something like, yeah, we have a string quartet plus bass. We have a piano. We have celeste. We have two percussionists. We have, we have flute, oboe, clarinet, and French horn, I believe, and bassoon.
It's a nice, tight ensemble.
Yeah.
And it's more intimate this way.
It is more intimate this way. You can hear the textures more clearly. I don't think it suffers. I mean, of course, it's not the same sort of epic scope, but I think there is something to be said for, especially with poetry that's this personal, I think there's something to be said for doing it in chamber music style, you know.
Well, Sunday, June 11th, 7:30 p.m., Huntington Gardens, Celestina will be performing this extraordinary piece. So the website is celestina.org, S-A-L-A-S-T-I-N-A.
Thank you. Yep, that's right.
And in the fall, you'll start your next season.
That's right, yeah.
What can we look forward to?
We have been doing this Shostakovich cycle, and we're going to continue that. And we're going to perform all of the chamber music of Shostakovich, and it'll take a couple of years. We are partnering with an Indian Kathak dance company, and we will be performing with them. We're going to play some Hindu bhajans, which is like devotional songs, and that will be in chamber music style too, but there will be choreography to that, as well as to a piece of music that was written for us called American Mirror. That's by Derek Skye, and it's a fantastic piece, and we have performed this once. The choreography is just beautiful. So those are two things that are going to be happening.
I played Derek Skye before on my show. Yeah,
tell me about it.
Well, I featured his music before.
Oh, I see.
Uh-huh. And a real composer light in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And in Los Angeles, it's a place where you get Kathak dance and chamber music, and they're like all
right?
put together.
Yeah,
and it turns out to be remarkable.
Yeah, we had one event, sort of like a test event, and it was really successful. So that will be in the fall.
Yeah. Celestina.org, June 11th, 7:30, Huntington Gardens.
That's right.
Thank you so much, Kevin Kumar.
Thank you. Thank you, Pete. I appreciate it.
The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe, read by Quanah J. Hicks. Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door. "'Tis some visitor," I muttered, "tapping at my chamber door, only this and nothing more." Ah, distinctly I remember it was in the bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor. Eagerly I wished the morrow. Vainly I had sought to borrow from my books surcease of sorrow, sorrow for the lost Lenore, for the rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore, nameless here forevermore. And the silken, sad, uncertain rustling of each purple curtain thrilled me, filled me with fantastic terrors never felt before, so that now, to still the beating of my heart, I stood repeating, 'Tis some visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door, some late visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door, this it is, and nothing more.' Presently my soul grew stronger, hesitating then no longer. 'Sir,' said I, 'or madam, truly your forgiveness I implore, but the fact is I was napping, and so gently you came rapping, and so faintly you came tapping, tapping at my chamber door, that I scarce was sure I heard you.' Here I opened wide the door. Darkness there and nothing more. Deep into that darkness peering, long I stood there wondering, fearing, doubting, dreaming dreams no mortal ever dared to dream before. But the silence was unbroken, and the stillness gave no token, and the only word there spoken was the whispered word, 'Lenore.' This I whispered, and an echo murmured back the word, 'Lenore.' Merely this, and nothing more. Back into the chamber turning, all my soul within me burning. 'Surely,' said I, 'surely that is something at my window lattice. Let me see then what thereat is, and this mystery explore. Let my heart be still a moment, and this mystery explore. 'Tis the wind, and nothing more.' Open here I flung the shutter, when, with many a flirt and flutter, in there stepped a stately raven of the saintly days of yore. Not the least obeisance made he, not a minute stopped or stayed he, but with mien of lord or lady, perched above my chamber door, perched upon a bust of palace just above my chamber door, perched and sat, and nothing more. Then this ebony bird beguiling my sad fancy into smiling by the grave and stern decorum of the countenance it wore. 'Though thy crest be shorn and shaven, thou,' I said, 'art sure no craven, ghastly, grim, and ancient raven, wandering from the nightly shore? Tell me what thy lordly name is on the night's Plutonian shore.' Quoth the raven, 'Nevermore.' Much I marveled this ungainly fowl to hear discourse so plainly, though its answer little meaning, little relevancy bore. For we cannot help agreeing that no living human being ever yet was blessed with seeing bird above his chamber door, bird or beast upon the sculptured bust above his chamber door, with such name as Nevermore. But the raven, sitting lonely on the placid bust, spoke only that one word, as if his soul in that one word he did outpour. Nothing farther than he uttered, not a feather than he fluttered, till I scarcely more than muttered, 'Other friends have flown before. On the morrow he will leave me, as my hopes have flown before.' Then the bird said, 'Nevermore.' Startled at the stillness broken by reply so aptly spoken, 'Doubtless,' said I, 'what it utters is its only stock and store caught from some unhappy master whom unmerciful disaster followed fast and followed faster till his songs one burden bore, till the dirges of his hope that melancholy burden bore of never, nevermore.' But the raven, still beguiling all my fancy into smiling, straight I wheeled a cushioned seat in front of bird and bust and door. Then upon the velvet sinking, I betook myself to linking fancy unto fancy, thinking what this ominous bird of yore, what this grim, ungainly, ghastly, gaunt, and ominous bird of yore meant in croaking, 'Nevermore.' This I sat engaged in guessing, but no syllable expressing to the fowl whose fiery eyes now burned into my bosom's core. This and more, I sat divining with my head at ease, reclining on the cushion's velvet lining that the lamplight gloated o'er, but whose velvet violet lining with the lamplight gloating o'er, she shall press, ah, nevermore. Then, methought the air grew denser, perfumed from an unseen censer swung by seraphim, whose footfalls tinkled on the tufted floor. Wretch, I cried, thy God hath lent thee, by these angels he hath sent thee respite, respite and nepenthe from thy memories of Lenore. Quaff, O quaff this kind nepenthe, and forget this lost Lenore, quoth the raven, nevermore. Prophet, said I, thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil, whether tempter sent or whether tempest tossed thee here ashore, desolate yet all undaunted on this desert land enchanted, on this home by horror haunted, tell me truly, I implore, is there balm in Gilead? Tell me, I implore, quoth the raven, nevermore. Prophet, said I, thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil, by that heaven that bends above us, by that God we both adore, tell this soul with sorrow laden if within the distant Aden it shall clasp a sainted maiden whom the angels name Lenore. Clasp a rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Be that word our sign of parting, bird or fiend, I shrieked, upstarting. Get thee back into the tempest and the night's plutonian shore. Leave no black plume as a token of that lie thy soul hath spoken. Leave my loneliness unbroken. Quit the bust above my door. Take thy beak from out my heart and take thy form from off my door. Quoth the raven, nevermore. And the raven, never flitting, still is sitting on the pallid bust of Pallas just above my chamber door. And his eyes have all the seeming of a demon's that is dreaming, and the lamplight o'er him streaming throws his shadow on the floor. And my soul from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor shall be lifted nevermore.
We are coming to the end of the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, I interview Kevin Kumar, one of the founders of a lovely local chamber music group called Celestina. We started the show with a piece by Brianna Tam, an innovative loop cellist, performing Unholy by Sam Smith. Before the interview, William Walton's The Princess in the Tower, and after the interview, Debussy's Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun, both performed by Celestina, and then a poem read by Quanah J. Hicks, The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe. You can find Quanah at Poets of Yore on Instagram. I'm devoting the entire show next week to the many talents of Quanah J. Hicks. And we wrapped up today's show with a couple of pieces by John von Segern from his album about to be released called Ambient Bass Guitar. We heard Adumbrations and Reflection. John will be performing on June 15th at the Philosophical Research Society, an ambient bass sound bath. Well, that's it for today. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week with the best of talk radio. Mystic Pete out!